Sears, Columbia River Keepers Conservation Director, Charlie Miller, retired ocean ecologist and Oregon State University professor, Jacqueline Keeler, Navajo Yankton Sioux writer and activist whose family has been fighting the Keystone XL pipeline in South Dakota, Cheryl Johnson, resident of Clatsop County who helped stop an LNG facility on the coast earlier, Pamela Ordway, landowner in Southern Oregon whose family is impacted by the proposed pipeline, Alexander Harris, who organized a 232-mile resistance hike along the proposed LNG pipeline route in Southern Oregon called Hike the Pipe, and Marlena Murphy of Portland Rising Tide. A couple of acronyms that you'll be hearing. JCEP stands for Jordan Cove Energy Project, and FERC refers to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And also in some of the presentation, they do refer to slides that are being shown on the screen, but I think it is all pretty readily understandable. So let's go to that audio right now.
So to give you a little bit of context, we're talking about two different proposals and associated pipelines to ship super-cooled natural gas as liquid natural gas overseas. I work with Columbia River Keeper, which is an organization that's been dealing with this for about 10 years on the Columbia River. You could set aside all of the climate issues around taking fracked gas, liquefying it, and shipping it across the world, and these are still terrible, terrible ideas. And so I'm going to start at least by talking about these two projects and kind of where give you a map of where they are, where they would be. The Oregon LNG project, right at the mouth of the Columbia River. This project has been on the books, proposed for 10 years. It started as an import project. Now they want to liquefy and export. The same goes for Jordan Cove LNG down in Coos Bay. For these two projects, there would be over 230 miles of pipelines each to funnel gas into these projects. These fall into the context of multiple coal, oil, propane, now methanol, and other gas export projects all over the West Coast. We are looking at multiple Keystone XLs worth of fossil fuels headed out, and there are no bigger projects than these two LNG terminals, which, for my money, might be the worst projects Oregon has ever seen. And I'll explain about that a bit more. So this cuts to the heart of the matter. LNG has been touted as this bridge fuel, as a way to get off of coal. What's really, really important is to know that that's an absolute fiction. We've learned a lot in the last 5 years about how damaging natural gas production, transmission, and liquefaction can be. What we've learned is that the leakage of methane is such a powerful part of this process that it completely eliminates any advantage that natural gas would have over coal. So what you see in this graph, and this is from a paper, a scientific paper from Bob Howarth at Cornell, a radical institution, Cornell University. What you see at the top is the part of the climate impact that comes from methane. And what you see at the bottom is the part of the climate impact that comes from, that's the CO2. So that's what goes in the atmosphere from combusting this stuff. What leaks out, what's really important, is those big red bars associated with natural gas. What we're learning is that there's so much methane leaked out during the production and transmission of this gas that it is as bad or worse than coal. Now add to that, you have to take this stuff, liquefy it, ship it across the world, then regasify it. That on its own is a 25 to 30% penalty, carbon penalty, because it's such an energy-intensive process. They need to build a 450-megawatt power plant in Coos Bay just to power, all by itself, the liquefied natural gas export facility that's proposed there. It gives you a sense for this is a climate disaster. This is Oregon's Keystone XL. These projects are nuts. Any politician who wants to be a climate leader has to be on the right side of this issue. And that's very important, and that's why you see pictures of Governor Brown around the room. She has the power she needs to say no to these projects. And that's where what's really important is that there's been this huge movement around stopping coal exports, a huge movement around dealing with these explosive oil trains. What we need now is for everyone here to commit to being involved in the fight against liquefied natural gas exports. It's the only way we're going to stop this. These guys are still touting themselves as a climate benefit. Our previous governor, John Kitzhaber, said, we think there are big climate benefits with doing LNG versus coal. We know that that's a scientific fiction. We can prove it, and it's time to call Governor Brown out on it. The broad analysis done by FERC really looked only at the very narrow part of how much methane is combusted, how much greenhouse, how much CO2 that produces. And even in their most narrow analysis, what we find is that Jordan Cove would immediately become the biggest greenhouse gas polluter in the state of Oregon as soon as the Boardman power plant shut down. And that's without looking at the life cycle. That's without looking at the fracking or the end use. That's just looking at the power plant and the facility itself. It's what kind of fuses all these projects together. We're dealing with oil, we're dealing with coal, we're dealing with LNG. The only way for Oregon to meet its greenhouse goals, to become a leader on climate change, is to say no to all of these. And that's why we're here, is really to put LNG on the table with all these other fossil fuels. So, like I said at the beginning, and I'm going to be quick here, these projects would be terrible ideas, even if you set that aside. And you just looked at the environmental impacts of putting these things in the ground. These pipelines at 36 inches, high-pressure, non-odorized pipelines would cut across some of the most rugged landscapes in Oregon. We have people here who are going to speak to kind of a close-up view of the pipelines. But this is what it looks like when pipeline installation doesn't go correctly. And there's someone here who actually witnessed this pipeline installation in 2003. This would impact hundreds of rivers and streams across the state for both of these projects. I mean, it's truly unimaginable to think about giving away Oregon's authority and saying yes to this type of project. So they would be remodeling these estuaries, these critical salmon estuaries. In Coos Bay, this would be the largest single-purpose dredging project in Oregon's history. So we're not talking about channel deepening. We're talking about for a single purpose, a single terminal. This would be the biggest one ever. Absolutely enormous. This is the worst project Oregon has ever seen. It would do more damage to this estuary than anything we've ever seen. The pipelines would cross more streams and rivers than almost anything ever we've ever seen. Maybe the I-5 rivals it. You know, and these are the stakes. And you add to that the enormous climate change impact, and you can see why there's such a movement congealing around this. And it's been going on for a long time. And Cheryl Johnson is here to talk about the successful fight against these projects. These are beautiful estuaries. These are places that are critical salmon habitat. People live very close to them. People fish in these areas. It would make no sense on its own to do this kind of damage to these places just to ship fracked gas overseas. When you know what the stakes are in climate terms, it makes these projects even more unacceptable. The great news is this. Oregon has all the power it needs to say no. If Governor Brown woke up tomorrow and came out and said, I don't see a future for LNG in Oregon, these projects would be in big trouble. They would dry up and their investors would pull out. We've seen this happen. Governor Kulongoski came out and challenged the Bradwood LNG project. Its investors pulled out. It went bankrupt. And the state of Oregon denied that project. And Cheryl's here to talk about that. But what's really important, if you leave with one thing, it's that the state of Oregon has the power to say no to this. There are a buffet of different permitting options for them to say no. They could say no under the Clean Water Act, under the Coastal Zone Management Act. They could use their own proprietary authority the way California did and said, you can't have a lease to use our land for this crazy fracked gas export project. What we need is the political will for the state of Oregon to do just that, and that's why we're here. What I want to do is introduce Dr. Miller. He's up here from Corvallis, who's going to give us kind of an up-close view of these terminals and what is actually involved in taking natural gas, supercooling it, and liquefying it and shipping it out. And then Jackie Keeler is going to speak about kind of the bigger picture and what we're dealing with these projects overall. With no further ado, Charlie.
When I was 24, I went to Alaska, and I saw the impact in Kodiak Island of the tsunami that hit after the 9.0 earthquake there. The trees had been swept off the mountainsides 300 feet up. These are huge events. So when I heard that they were planning to build LNG terminals where tsunamis are almost certain to come in the not-too-distant future, I thought, that's the stupidest thing I'd ever heard of. So, what is LNG? We're going to export it through Oregon from these two sites, the Jordan Cove Energy Project in Coos Bay, North Bend, the north end of the bay, and Oregon LNG in Warrenton. Why would anyone do this? Well, money, of course. High natural gas prices in Asia relative to what we can do here now that we've got fracking going all over Pennsylvania and Colorado. And in 2014, the price difference was about $12. Amazingly, it's dropped to just over $5. And that may help us. I don't know. At present, the investors in doing this are for JSEP Veresen, which is a Canadian pipeline company. Their value is around $3 billion Canadian dollars. And for Oregon LNG, it's Leucadia National, which is mostly invested in beef, and they're
capital value is around $55 billion. Oregon ports attract exporters partly because our weak environmental laws and history of rejecting LNG and other fossil fuel export projects from California and Washington. So what makes it transportable by ship to get at this Asian market is that you can liquefy it. The ships look like this. These we can get into the Columbia estuary. They're super Panamax. That means they go. They're the biggest thing that can go through the newly enlarged Panama Canal. An LNG tanker is over 1,000 feet length overall. And the total export from our two ports would be 5.6 million tons a year at up to 100 plus thousand metric tons per load. For Warrington, that would be around 83 empty ships in and loaded ships out. They actually don't come in empty. They come in ballast in seawater. Coos Bay isn't dredged quite so deep, so it can't get these biggest one in, so its actual amounts are projected are less. Where are these places? This is the Dogami tsunami evacuation map for Coos Bay Peninsula. It has a long spit that protects the bay, and they're going to put this LNG plant right there where the arrow points. There'll be a power plant to run it, driven with natural gas, and then there'll be a port dredged in here and a liquefaction plant there. And on these maps, the orange is what would be flooded in a distant tsunami. Tsunami from a distant subduction earthquake, as in Alaska or Tohoku, Japan. The orange is what would be flooded in a local earthquake, a local subduction earthquake, due to our Cascadia subduction zone offshore. So you can see that this will all get flooded in a local subduction earthquake, which is everybody in Northwest is worrying about appropriately. DOE has approved only 6 million tons per year out of JSEP. Next. And this is the Skipanon Peninsula where they're proposing to put the Oregon LNG plant. It's approved for 9.6 million tons, and it too will all be flooded in a local earthquake, as will, and it's very important, all of the main city of Warrington. The access roads will be gone. The bridge will be gone. Probably the bridge to Washington will be gone. The 9.0 earthquake is just as important as the tsunami. It's going to shake like crazy. Okay, so that's where they are. How do you get the gas? Well, you dig it up. You drill a well, and there are standard gas deposits that come up mostly as natural gas. Or by fracking, you drill a well, you pump high-pressure fluids into a spray of horizontal wells at the bottom of the spread. And that's being done in Colorado, Utah, and Canada, at least for the gas that we'll get here. It's also being done in Pennsylvania and Texas. Then you compress the gas. And for pipeline transport here, they're proposing to compress the gas to 1,500 PSI, which is 100 atmospheres. That's the pressure a submarine must withstand at 1,000 meters depth in the sea. It's very high pressure. It's a welding problem for super professional welders. And the Williams company that's doing this is having breaks all the time in their present pipeline systems. For JSEP, it's 232 miles of pipeline, 400 water crossings of different sorts, four of the major rivers. To the Skipanon, it's 82, 120 water crossings, including a horizontally drilled 3-foot diameter pipe going under the Columbia from Woodland, Washington, over to the Oregon coast of the Columbia. These are huge engineering projects, and even though it's going to export less, JSEP costs more because it takes so much more pipeline. Then you clean the gas. In order to refrigerate the majority, which is methane, you have to take out the carbon dioxide, which will otherwise jam the pipes with dry ice. You have to take out things like mercury, which will plate the pipes and make a mess. You can leave in the nitrogen and the oxygen, even the hydrogen sulfide. You take out the ethane and the propane and the butane because they're more valuable in natural gas than methane, and you want to sell those as such for people who have a propane tank in their backyard. So you clean all that up, which is an expensive and complex chemical process. Then you liquefy it.
And the reason for showing you all of this is that some of the chemicals involved make the process much more dangerous. You start off at room temperature with gaseous methane, which you purified. You put it into the freezer compartment of a huge refrigerator. You compress the acting refrigerant, propane, in a compressor, and put it through a heat exchanger. When you compress a gas, it heats up. You take that heat out and then re-evaporate that, and then it's cooled, so it takes heat out of the freezer compartment, which lowers the methane to about minus 95 Fahrenheit. In the second refrigerator compartment, you use ethylene. Ethylene is two carbons double bonded, which is extremely flammable, dangerous stuff. And that does make the gas, the methane, liquid. So it's liquid at about minus 121 Fahrenheit. It's refrigerated here to minus 139. And then in the third compartment, using methane or isopentane, you lower it to 260 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a little like condensing some water and then cooling it down to 33 degrees centigrade, so it'll stay cold in water. And so this doesn't need to be pressurized in the ships to keep it liquid. And you store it. And the storage tank at Astoria is going to be 160 feet, 66 feet high. That's 17 stories. There, for example, from this little figure, is the Astoria Tower. There are going to be two of these tanks. They each hold 90 million gallons. They're almost as long as a football field, the diameter the same as a football field. So these are gargantuan objects. And they will sit on the outer tip of the peninsula. The peninsula is narrow. The plant will basically fill the whole outer end of it. This trestle goes out to a dock out here where the ships will dock, and the liquid gas will be pumped out and loaded on the ships from these two tanks, which I've just described. Dan will say something more about the vapor that has to be burned off, so that's in there. And in those refrigerant tanks, we have ethylene, which is 15,000 gallons, propane, 14,000 gallons, and isopentane, 31,000 gallons. And the problem is that particularly this stuff, if you mix it with methane, becomes a fuel air bomb. And any spark will be a phenomenal, destructive, village-ruining horror. But there it goes. And that was pointed out in a review of the environmental impact statement for the JSAP plant by two chemical engineers from across the country, a Canadian and a guy from Arkansas, Dennert and Hazen. So this is part of the danger that we have to use these amazingly difficult chemicals. One of the things to remember about this is if you're going to do this at all, you have to do it from a coast. And all I can say is the Oregon coast is too risky, and one of the main reasons is that we are bordered by the Cascadia subduction zone, where the North American Point is sliding over the Juan de Fuca Point. And it does that at an intermittent rate of about once every 500 years up here in Warrenton area, about twice that often down in Coos Bay. And these are huge earthquakes, according to the geological arguments that I believe. And then what's causing, we see in the marshes of the coast, tsunamis have come a mile and more inland here, and they went that far and farther in Japan. And the Japanese were the world's experts in tsunamis, and they underestimated how big it could be in Tohoku. They built retaining walls they thought would hold them. They were wrong. They didn't get it right. And so they had this enormous damage. Well, maybe we'll get it right, maybe we won't. So here's the estimate. This is what the tsunamis look like. This is meters above Milo seawater. That's what that means. And basically, we expect for different sizes of earthquakes, we can expect about a 10-meter jump. Well, that's what they modeled, and these are very good models, so 30 feet. And they're going to have a big berm, and the problem is that the tsunami is not like this. This is from the Alaska earthquake of 64, and what happens is that the land drops first, and it drops about, these are in meters, about a half a meter or a meter. So we reset the zero level to here. And then comes the tsunami. up and down. And this is 1800 when this first one hit. And they don't stop until around 5 o'clock the next morning. And the biggest one isn't the first one. So they wash in, they wash out, they wash, and they're going to wash away the Skipanon Peninsula. And I don't care what you do to secure the thing in the ground, and FERC has required extraordinary securing, there's going to be nothing there. And there'll be no town to get there from where the people who are supposed to go and deal with the plant live, because they're going to be digging out their wife from under the house beam. This is a crazy scheme. Whenever these tsunamis come through, they break pipes. Those things find sparks, you get fires. And we're going to have fires. An LNG import terminal at Chiba on Tokyo Bay. One of the things that both Oregon LNG and JSEP and the FERC EIS thing say is, oh, there were no fires at LNG plants in Tohoku during the huge earthquake. Well, there was one LNG plant which didn't have any stored LNG, as it turned out, and it tore all the piping to shreds. But there wasn't a fire because there wasn't any LNG at the time. But down here in Chiba, which is a long way from the epicenter, it broke a bunch of pipes, it caught fire, it burned for 11 days and killed 6 firemen. So this is dangerous stuff, and I'm opposed to doing it. I love this picture. This is from the draft environmental impact statement for Oregon LNG. It comes from FERC. They mostly use Oregon LNG and consultant data to draw these things up. But somebody at FERC put this picture in, which is the Washington Expansion Pipeline, a 3-foot pipeline, 140 miles long, 3 feet in diameter, 1,500 PSI, to bring the gas down from Canada that's going to go into the Warrington plant. And that 95-foot strip is within 50 feet. The pipe is within 50 feet of 740 houses. Is that a good idea? Well, somebody at FERC knew that, or that wouldn't have been on the code. So, FERC, their EIS is always in their executive summary with a statement exactly like this. In fact, they cribbed exactly this text for the Warrington plant out of the EIS for the JSEP plant. We determined that construction and operation of the project would result in adverse environmental impacts, but most impacts would be reduced to less than significant levels. That's your government, isn't it fun?
So our next speaker is going to provide a little bit more context, because these projects fall into a larger picture of fossil fuel extraction and export. So Jackie Keeler is here to talk a little bit about how these projects line up with some of the other issues we're dealing with. And with that.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am a writer and activist. I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and we introduce ourselves by our clans, and our clans are matrilineal, so you inherit your clan from your mother's mother. So my clan is Kia'ani, and I was born for my father's people, who are the Yankton, the Ahangtawan Dakota people. And my Che, my maternal grandfather's clan is Heshkanzo, and my paternal grandfather's clan, well, he's also Ihangtawan Dakota, so he doesn't have a Navajo clan. But and that's how we introduce ourselves, by our ancestry, and then we know each other. My perspective is one of, as you notice, I belong to two different tribes in two very different areas of the United States. And my husband is Six Nations from Canada. And all of our communities have been impacted by these fossil fuel extractive industries. This summer, I went home for my family reunion. And where was my family? My family was in Pierre, South Dakota, attending the Keystone XL pipeline. It's pretty much where we had our family reunion. And they had the state hearings to see if they were going to renew the permit and for TransCanada. And this impacts my father's reservation, and his family have been very active in fighting it. And I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, what does unity look like? I mean, my mother's community, I should also say, is impacted by uranium mining. There are still open uranium mines on my grandparents' land. Right next to their house is a very large uranium mine. They put a fence around it, a little chain link fence. And I think that's all they did, the government. And so I think that one of the things I want to talk about is sovereignty, and how does this impact the fight, and how can we work together to stop these projects? Certainly, indigenous nations are often on the front lines of these fights because they impact our lives directly. With this LNG project, it impacts the salmon habitats and also the cultural historical sites for a number of tribes in Oregon. Certainly the Jordan Cove Bay one, the Confederated tribes from Coos and Lower Umpquans will have all come out to say that that is a cultural historical site and have opposed the construction of it without further consultation. And that's a very important term, consultation. As sovereign nations, we have certain rights to the lands, and we also have the right to consultation. My husband's tribe up in Canada, they blockaded the Enbridge line that was running through their lands and demanding consultation. And that's obviously affecting my husband's community, too. It affects all of us. And I just really want to urge you to reach out to those communities. I think they can be your greatest allies. About two and a half years ago, my Aunt Faith's Spot Eagle, she put together a group called the Cowboys and Indians. I was back on the reservation, and she was running a conference. And she brought up all these white farmers from Nebraska and South Dakota, the Dakota Rural Alliance. And it was really fascinating because on one hand, growing up, I often felt we were at odds with those white communities. Yet here they were standing with us on this issue because we all are impacted because we live on the land. And the land is what makes us relatives to each other. You know, in the end, I mean, after 100 and some years, you know, we were actually working together. And it was really inspiring. And when we were at the hearings in South Dakota in Pierre, you know, we were all there staying in one big house together with all our attorneys. and all the tribes were unified. We, you know, it was so great to see the Yankton Sioux tribal attorney. You know, she did an amazing job, you know, presenting our case, and all the tribal attorneys, and also those for the farmers and ranchers as well. And it is their testimony and their documentation, this very careful documentation he did of how crazy these schemes are, because, you know, unless we stand up and say something and point these out, they're not going to consider those. The money is going to speak and run these sorts of crazy schemes right through our lives, our homes, and our futures. I think that a lot of people don't understand what sovereignty means. I think they think it's just a word that, you know, Indian people are using, but actually has a legal basis, and it's these legal bases that can be used to challenge these projects. The U.S. Congress did not ratify treaties with, you know, random groups of people. They only ratify treaties with other sovereign nations. And so, you know, when tribes take a stand, this has a big effect on these proceedings. I think that's the larger scope, and this has had a huge impact. I mean, up north where these, in Canada, in British Columbia, you know, the Supreme Court ruling that came out of this with the tribes demanding consultation has really increased and refined the scope of their sovereignty to a greater degree. And I think that if we work together, that we can achieve a lot.
So our next speaker is going to give probably the most hopeful part of what we have to talk about tonight, aside from the action. I've taken it away from everyone else. But Cheryl Johnson is a community leader who's been fighting LNG for over 10 years. And she's part of the successful fight to stop the Bradwood LNG terminal. And with no further ado, Cheryl, come on up.
I traveled from Astoria to be here this evening, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm a retired school librarian and a grandmother of two, and our home is within walking distance of the Columbia River estuary. This estuary is also known as a salmon nursery, and unfortunately, currently, the Columbia River estuary is also home to 13 species of salmon that are threatened or endangered. In 2004, LNG reared its ugly head, and by 2005, there were four separate LNG projects proposed for the Columbia River. They were proposed as import terminals because the energy was needed by the United States. Soon there were only two proposals left standing, Oregon LNG, which we are still finding today, and Bradwood Landing, proposed by Northern Star, which we're going to explore today. How do we, as ordinary citizens, defeat mega corporations fueled by greed? How do we defend when they are defended by staples of high-priced lawyers and, my favorite vocabulary word I learned from Dan, prostitutes? As citizens, we have a lot of power. My dear friend Peter Hutala, a longtime defender of the river, taught me about a three-legged stool. The power to vote means that we elect honest representatives and create and support wise legislation. Legal battles involve challenging the permitting at the state, at the local, at the federal levels. The power of public opinion gives us the opportunity to educate and to motivate our neighbors, our friends, our community, the entire state. Unfortunately, there is no silver bullet in defeating LNG or any of the many fossil fuel proposals that are showing up on our Columbia River now. And we must be working on all three legs of the stool simultaneously. However, all things are possible. And in 2010, we were shocked to wake up and read the headlines in the local paper. The headline read, Bradwood Landing halts LNG permitting. And then the very following day, the headline read, Bradwood Landing declares bankruptcy. I want to share with you this evening how these three legs of the stool led to citizen victory in this one example. One of the legs involves our power as voters. In 2008 in Clatsop County, we passed a countywide referendum on no pipelines in parks. It was the only issue on the ballot. The voter turnout was 58%, and the referendum passed by a whopping 67%. This vote was legally effective because we tied the referendum to a flawed land use decision. So that was on the local level. On the state level, we worked hard in Salem to defeat a fast-track bill for permitting pipelines. The opposition came back the following year, and we again worked with our legislators to defeat them. Unfortunately, on the third year, we were not successful, and the bill did pass. Although it passed in that third session, this legislative fight made it clear that our movement was broad, bipartisan, and powerful. In 2008, we successfully recalled the chair of the Clatsop County Commissioners, and in 2010, we began working to recruit and to elect county commissioners who represented us and the majority of our communities. Over time, we successfully replaced in Clatsop County all four of the county commissioners who had originally voted yes on the LNG pipeline. The next leg focuses on legal challenges and challenge we did at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level. When the Clatsop County commissioners ignored their staff report and voted to permit the pipeline, we took them to court. When we took them to court, CRPFIC, which is the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, they were part of that legal challenge, and CRPFIC and the fishing nations, the Native American fishing nations, were a very important partner throughout this process. LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals, rejected the county approval and sided with Columbia Riverkeeper, who had represented us in court. On the federal level, FERC also approved the terminal and the pipeline. With a great deal of public pressure in 2010, the states of Oregon and Washington challenged the FERC approval in court and in the federal court, and 15 states filed amicus briefs in support of Washington and Oregon. And always, we focused on the state permitting. In 2007 and in 2010, DEQ held public hearings, and we packed them with our signature red shirts. Amazingly enough, in 2011, DEQ denied the 401 water certification. This was a huge victory, and this victory was a combination of excellent comments submitted by Columbia Riverkeeper and informed public testimony. The third leg is public involvement, which is opportunities to educate and to involve. We brought Dr. Jerry Havens to Astoria on two different occasions to teach all of us about the magnitude of the potential fires from LNG spills. Dan Sears and other locals led many hikes along the proposed terminal site. We held media events along the pipeline, including Bark, who led hikes for the Mount Hood pipeline proposal. This inspired a whole new set of people to be involved in the Portland communities. Community was invited to workshops on LNG issues, on sign making, training in how to testify to state agencies. And always we are reaching out to different groups impacted by the fossil fuel import-export. The Columbia River fishing families, many of whom go back four generations, brought out their fishing vessels for this rally offshore from the proposed Bradwood Terminal. The farmers brought their tractors when we went to Salem for a rally in 2010. They organized and put enormous pressure on the local elected leaders and on state officials to protect rural Oregon. They brought the strategy and the concept that stopping the terminal would stop the pipeline. There is no silver bullet, but there are multiple paths to victory because citizens have power. We have power in many forms. All legs of the stool require ongoing participation by communities and by individuals to make this a statewide concern. And victory is possible.
Okay, so the next part of this is Alice and Pam are going to come up and give us kind of a really up-close view of what these pipeline proposals look like on the ground. So, Pam?
Many others can speak much more eloquently about the local and global environmental impacts this project, the Jordan Cove project, would cause. But what I'd like to talk about is what this proposed pipeline is doing to those who just happen to have had the bad luck to own property along the way. I, along with four brothers and sisters, own 153 acres in the path of the proposed pipeline. It's in the small community of Camas Valley. It's roughly halfway between Roseburg and Coos Bay. Like many of our neighbors, we aren't the first generation to own the land. Our father purchased it as a young man in the 1930s and then built a house for his new wife and what would become a passel of kids. Other than the farm that he grew up on just a couple of miles away, this farm was the only home he ever knew, and he passed away there at the age of 90, proud to pass on what he considered his legacy. That was back in 2003, and we've tried to manage the land in a manner that would honor our father's wishes. Like him, we have logged some areas, always following Oregon's forestry practices management requirements to the T, and in most cases, going well beyond, leaving stands of timber to lessen the impact on neighbors' views and bypassing areas where we knew our favorite wildflowers from childhood flourished, always consulting with forestry professionals to ensure that logged areas were replanted appropriately and managed to promote healthy forest land for future generations. Like our father, we've also looked at crops appropriate for the part of property that's farmland. We have a vision for passing this land on to our children in the hope they will pass it on to theirs. As part of that process, we look at what crops we can add to use the farmland to its best potential, and we see many exciting possibilities. Douglas County is becoming successful in producing more and more varieties of quality wine grapes. New developments are being made in growing hazelnut trees inoculated with the fungus that produced the highly sought-after culinary truffle. And again, Douglas County has areas ideal for the growth of this new crop. And as more and more breweries sprout up throughout the state, not all want to track to the Willamette Valley for their hops, so the possibility of growing hops in Douglas County is becoming a reality. The one thing all of these require is a substantial investment in the land, both in time and money. Farming's not for those wanting to make a quick return on their investment. It's for those willing to make a long-term commitment to both time and money. And this is where the line between sustainable long-term commitment to land and a rape-and-run mentality cross. As I said, we're committed to managing our land to the best of our abilities and passing it on to future generations in the hopes that they'll pass it on to theirs. But the threat of this pipeline has us in a holding pattern. We're not moving forward with any of our plans because we just don't know what the future holds. And it's been like this for a long time. The nightmare began in December 2007 when Jordan Cove first applied to FERC for approval to import liquefied natural gas. The U.S. production ballooned. Importing LNG began to make little sense, and we all breathed a collective sigh of relief. But for a very short while, because almost immediately Jordan Cove applied to change the purpose from import to export. So for those of us who line the path of the proposed pipeline, it's been almost 8 years of upheaval. We defer plans to make improvements. We spend countless hours attending planning and county commissioner meetings, writing letters to elected officials and editors of newspapers. We donate money to organizations fighting against the Jordan Cove project. And in our case, we banded together with other landowners, spending money we could ill afford in order to mount a legal battle to fight blatantly unfair land use decisions. But as much as I'm telling you our tale of frustration and disappointment, we are the lucky ones. While we have wonderful memories of growing up on the property and we consider it a part of who we are, none of us currently resides there. We continue to fight the best we know how, but when it's said and done, we do get to go back to our homes elsewhere and push it from our minds a bit. Most of our neighbors aren't so lucky. If allowed, the pipeline will go past their barns and their homes, tearing up orchards that have been nurtured for years, threatening wells that supply their drinking water, and forest land held in trust for a rainy day. It'll leave an ugly scar in its wake because vegetation removed won't be allowed to grow back. Our neighbor to the east moved into her farm as a teenage bride in the early 1950s. And has been there ever since. She tells me she can't sleep at night. She worries what will happen if the pipeline goes through. The current path puts the pipeline about 75 yards from her house. And she's seen the pictures. She's heard the stories. She knows if the pipeline is put in and there's an explosion, she's a statistic. And it's not the only threat keeping her up at night. The letters and phone calls we've all gotten have been incessant and intimidating. Offers for easement rights delivered to us clearly state that if FERC approves their proposals, they have the right to take our land through the eminent domain process, whether we want it or not. All of us along the pipeline received multiple letters from a law firm specializing in eminent domain and touting their close working relationship with the company that's proposing to build the pipeline. When my neighbor received those letters, she had to be reassured she wasn't being sued. That's not particularly surprising, as the language used is strong and, frankly, kind of scary. And if the letters aren't intimidating enough, the law firms have been calling landowners along the pipeline, too, acting as if the project has been approved and the pipeline's a done deal. Of course, we can all not answer the phone, toss the letters, take a walk in the woods to blow off steam, and that's when it gets even more disturbing. Stakes with orange flags magically appear, along with mystical spray-painted markings on trees and rocks. Feels like you've been kicked in the stomach. Something you don't want and are using all your resources to fight against seems to be steadily, unrelentingly creeping into your private world. Although there are numerous stories similar, I've used my neighbor Juanita's story as an example because I'm most familiar with it. In my mind, she and her farm are permanently connected. And for those I know along the path of the proposed pipeline, that's usually the case. The land they live on is intertwined between what they have and who they are. Properties are usually described by ownership, not addresses. It's Dancer's Place or Glenn's Corner or Wiley's Hill. So when the threat of the pipeline rears its ugly head, it isn't just a threat to the property they own. It's a threat to who they are. That's why the specter of eminent domain is such a hard pill to swallow. The roots are deep, and they really don't want to leave and start over somewhere else. Even if they did, they probably couldn't, because you'll find few people willing to pay a fair price for land that may end up with a buried pipeline full of explosive gas running under it. It's true that landowners will be compensated for easements, and I'd like to give you an example so that you can accurately put it in perspective. After being hounded for months, including phone calls, registered letters I declined to accept, unannounced appearances at my front door, I agreed to meet with the Jordan Cove representative so he could present his offer. He handed me a three-ring binder with a bunch of propaganda and a disturbingly accurate aerial photograph of our land, overlaid with the proposed route of the pipeline. When I flipped to the back of the book where the offer was, I was underwhelmed, to say the least. The total offer was $2,934.04. And the total number of acres directly impacted was 7. So I can do the math for you. I've done it before. It works out to be $419.15 per acre. Now, they say they're just paying us for an easement. The land's still ours to use. I say that's baloney. Well, actually, that's not what I'd say, but... If you remember when I started talking about how proud we were about going above and beyond reforestation practices required by the state, all the exciting possibilities of better utilize the farmland we have, exciting new crops we might be able to grow, well, all of that's at risk. The pipeline would go through the middle of the 100-foot-tall stand of timber we set aside as a habitat for our favorite wildflowers. It would cut a diagonal slice through farmland where we're planning on introducing new crops. And the carefully planned riparian management zones along the two streams across our land, a wasted effort, because the pipeline won't have to abide by those restrictions. It's hard to express how frustrating this has been, not only for my family and neighbors, but for the communities along the way. This is a fight we didn't ask for. Many communities along the pipeline have economies that are primarily timber-based, and as such, they are, and have been since the 1980s, economically depressed. They adjusted as best they could, doing without sheriffs, maintaining volunteer fire departments, scaling back to four-day school weeks. They were on the wrong side of the equation in the logging industry. Environmental restrictions, and perhaps more than they're willing to admit, market changes and technological advances have steadily increased unemployment. But they aren't callous, with no respect for the earth. They still hope for those jobs where they can be outside all day, up in the woods. They still hope to pass on what they have to future generations. And like us, they are looking to see how they can rethink ways to manage their land so they can stay on it for another generation. This pipeline goes through, it devalues their land, negates positive timber management projects, limits their options for future crops, and reduces their chances for being able to pull themselves out of the economic pit they've been in.
My name is Alexander Harris, and I organized a project this last summer called Hike the Pipe. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my experience, share a few stories. There are hundreds of stories just like that. That is, it's so powerful to hear it from a landowner, and that's just one of hundreds. So just imagine what our experience was to walk through these communities and hear that time and time and time again. It's really powerful. All right, so let me first tell you why I decided to organize Hike the Pipe. About 6 months ago, I was at an environmental law conference in Eugene, and I became aware of the Jordan Cove Energy Project. And immediately, the things that were most concerning to me were the 232-mile pipeline and clear cut, the hundreds of landowners threatened with eminent domain, and the construction of Oregon's largest greenhouse gas emitter, all to export liquefied natural gas. Now, I couldn't believe even one of those. And when they were all combined for export, I decided I'm doing something. So I quit my job, and I was able to work with an organization of landowners in Southern Oregon. They hired me for a few months. Eventually, I started an Indiegogo, and this became my life for the last 6 months. Let me tell you, though, what our goals were. The goals were simple. I saw the problem being a lack of awareness. It was clear to me that if I, somebody who is hanging out in environmental circles, I was passionate, I'm from Ashland originally, which is very close to the pipeline, if I hadn't heard about it, then most people just didn't know about it. And I decided that that was the chief problem. If we were going to solve this problem, we needed to spread awareness. So that was the first goal of Hike the Pipe. The way that we accomplished that goal was we documented the stories and images of the impacted communities and ecosystems. Once we had documented that, we shared broadly through social media, news media, our website and blog, and we are making a documentary. So we've filmed throughout the hike, and right now we're in the editing process. That was the first goal. The second goal was to generate solidarity with the individuals and the communities directly impacted. So the first way we did that was establishing who those people were. Unfortunately, the government, even though they're taking private and public land, is not publicizing what land they're taking. So they've released a draft environmental impact statement and now a final environmental impact statement for the Jordan Cove Energy Project. But in that impact statement, all they give you is small snapshots, small maps of 10 or 15 square miles at a time. Each map is always oriented differently, north-south. So you flip from page to page, and even if you know the territory, for instance, I would flip you know, and look at the place that I grew up just outside of Ashland, I couldn't recognize it. And I said, you know, this is a problem. We don't even know where this pipeline is. So what we did is with each of those maps, we generated landmarks, and we put those landmarks onto a broader map. We generated hundreds of dots. We connected those dots. We generated the pipeline. We overlaid taxing lot information, and we found out who the landowners were. And then all of a sudden, we had infrastructure to do something about this, connecting people. And when you connect people, crazy stuff happens. It's amazing. We sent out a letter to these individuals, these landowners who were impacted, and for most of them, they had never even heard from anybody opposing the Jordan Cove Energy Project. The only letters that they had received were from corporations. And in those letters, it talks about eminent domain, and it talks with all this legal language, and people feel like, oh, am I being sued? Did I do something wrong? They don't know how to navigate. So for them to see our letter telling them, no, just so you know, in fact, most people haven't signed, so don't let them lie to you. You don't have to sign. This doesn't have to happen. It was a morale booster for these people, and they were able to see an outlet to oppose and reject this project. We got dozens of responses, people saying, I want to be interviewed in your documentary, I want to meet the hikers, I want to participate. And that was wonderful for the hike because we got places to stay, we got places to get water, food, and a bunch of people organized events for us. I'll tell you about that in a little bit. We also had events in all four counties that were impacted that were largely planned by the communities themselves. And the last thing we did to accomplish this goal of generating solidarity was we had direct action trainings in these communities. So we invite these communities out and teach them what their rights were so that when they were, you know, using their constitutional rights, they weren't being misled by police officers and what they could and could not do. So those were our goals. And let me tell you about what happened. We started August 22nd in Malin, which is where the pipeline would begin. The pipeline would hook up with this pipeline that would be built, would hook up with a pipeline that's already built called the Ruby Pipeline. And that's where Malin is. This is gas hub. So really the middle of nowhere. We started off with four hikers. And we wanted to maintain at least four at all times, and we did. Two people went the entire way, and they're not here tonight, but you can see them in this photo. Emlyn and Turtle are their names, and they're fantastic individuals, very strong. They've walked across the state of Oregon. In early September, we had an event of about 50 people that came and joined us on the Pacific Crest Trail. They walked on this public land with us, and then we got to see where the Pacific Crest Trail would intersect with the Pacific Connector Pipeline, this proposal. Once we got to the intersection, I invited everybody, this is public land. You can walk here, you can wander, you can explore the trees, and most of them just looked at me saying, I can do that? This is mine? They didn't understand that this doesn't belong to the government, doesn't belong to the corporation, this is the people's land. And so they wandered and got to explore all these tagged trees, these beautiful old growth forests, and got to experience it themselves and build those emotional relationships with the land. It was a really powerful experience for me to share that with them. Then we proceeded to descend the Cascades. We were then in section two, approaching the Rogue River, and we actually got to be guided down by Rogue River Keeper. They guided us down the Rogue River. We floated for 5 miles and got to see where the pipeline would cross this amazing river. And we were actually welcomed by an event of over 200 people in Shady Cove that came out to support us and oppose LNG. There were landowners that talked. There were hikers that talked. There was live music, food. It was an excellent exchange of ideas and strategy. And then we just, from there, went north. We started approaching the Umpqua River. However, there was a fire in Southern Oregon this year called the Stouts Creek Fire. 17 miles of the proposed Pacific Connector pipeline burned. 17 miles of this proposed highly compressed gas pipeline were scorched in one of the worst fires in the Northwest this year. Several of those miles were bulldozed. They were active bulldozing sites where the fire was so out of control that they had to move land, cut down trees to prevent it. Now, we can all use our imagination to just think about what might happen if a 25-year-old firefighter is driving a bulldozer and hits something during a wildfire. This would be an explosion that would extend from compressor station to compressor station. So we're talking dozens of miles. That's a lot of land. That's a big danger. We eventually made it to Winston, where we had an event in Winston of 150 people, I think, came out. It was the same as Shady Cove, a really good exchange of ideas. And from there, we started climbing the coastal range. This was Section 5. This was an especially beautiful area, but it was especially painful because in the coastal range, if you don't know, every other square mile is private. So you will be walking through gorgeous, ancient, old-growth forest, and all of a sudden, you will hit clear-cut. You'll hit nothingness. And then you'll walk another mile, and all of a sudden, you're back in the forest. That's just how the BLM private land is patchworked there. So it was really easy to see what a clear-cut would look like there. You were in this beautiful forest, and then out of nowhere, there's a line drawn. Some arbitrary line drawn on the map becomes a real line that's destroys land on the ground. And it was painful to see that. It was painful emotionally to see that. Eventually, we made it to Coos Bay, where we had several hundred people come out. It was the biggest rally in Coos Bay that has happened yet for LNG. And we had a march. We marched to the top of the McCullough Bridge. There were over 100 people on that bridge. And we had 30 kayaktivists below us. All of this was overlooking Jordan Cove, where the largest greenhouse gas emitter would be built, and the terminal would be built. So it was this very powerful, kind of surreal experience. It was insanely windy, so the kayaktivists they struggled to get to where they were. But once they got there, they were stoked. And it was just this awesome opportunity to see the Coos Bay community come out and show their opposition to the project. Supporters of LNG argue that fossil fuel infrastructure is what Coos Bay wants and what Coos Bay needs to recover from its diminished economic state. It is true that Oregon is struggling. Southern Oregon is struggling. However, after seeing the entire pipeline route and hearing the stories of hundreds of rural Oregonians, I know that the people neither want nor need fossil fuel development. They seek and crave something more. Over the course of the hike, we heard many stories, each unique in their own way, but tied together by one common thread, that government is meant to protect the public interest of the citizens and not the special interest of corporations. In these communities, there is an overwhelming consensus all across the political spectrum that a Canadian corporation cannot use eminent domain to export fossil fuel. I heard Bernie supporters and Trump supporters say that exact thing. It was amazing to see that unity, that consensus. However, there's so much misinformation about what we are told that Southern Oregon wants this, and that if we take it away from them, then we need to do them a favor by giving them this. And if we take it away from them, then we're hurting them. That's just not true at all. That is what corporations are telling us, so we sign this off. But these communities know better. They've been exploited in the past, and they don't want to be exploited in the future. The problem here is that Southern Oregon is so alienated from the political process, so alienated that their voices are largely ignored. In other words, they are disproportionately impacted by environmental harms while simultaneously being alienated from the political process that produced those harms. Therefore, the responsibility to stop this project falls on the Portland metro area, where the vast majority of Oregon politics is conducted. Portland needs to confront this issue with as much enthusiasm as it has other fossil fuel export projects. For the effects are the same. Environmental justice and climate change see no geographical boundaries. Governor Kate Brown has the power to kill this project. And if we stand in solidarity with Southern Oregon, she will listen and we will win. Thank you.
Currently, the strategy is to get the governor to say no to this, as governors have in the past. There's a lot of, there's that precedent setting. I have full confidence that this is going to work and that Kate Brown is going to, as we said, wake up one morning and have that, like, oh, I have to come out against LNG moment, But anything we can do to push her in that direction is certainly useful. So we had an action a week and a half ago in Portland in which our Kate Brown went to our local Federal Energy Regulatory Commission office and declared eminent domain on their office. And we claimed it for the public good. Yeah. So we're going to keep doing things like that, and we'd love y'all's help. We have some big things coming up in early December, which we're going to be talking about and planning, and we have an art make scheduled for November 15th. Tentatively for that. And we're also going to have a hike out to the Warrenton site on November 7th. A lot of these plans are still in development. It's a rapidly shifting political scene, and we have to be quick on our feet with how we respond. But we'd love to have all of you involved. Hope to see y'all there.
And that was a panel on standing up to and obstructing, preventing LNG pipelines in Oregon. Recorded right here in Portland and presented by our friend Paul Rowland. Coming up next, it's 11:59 on KBOO Portland, is the also incomparable Moving On, hosted by the inimitable and what a guy, Don Jacobson. Keep it locked right here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now the KBOO News at noon for today, Friday, October 30th, 2015. I'm Don Merrill. In local news, the Wolf OR7, who became globally famous when he took off from his Northeast Oregon pack 4 years ago and wandered thousands of miles in search of a mate, is much harder to track now. Wildlife officials say the collar that transmitted his location through satellites and radio signals has stopped working. John Stevenson, a wolf coordinator with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Bend, said it all finally wore out. The battery basically died. Without the regular information, biologists have to rely on trail cameras and in-person sightings to monitor OR7. Clackamas River water customers in the Clackamas area will find out whether the boil water notice has been lifted by about 10 o'clock on Saturday. Water District Quality Manager Suzanne DiLorenzo said testing on water samples should indicate by Saturday morning whether bacteria levels are safe for drinking, cooking, and other home uses. The boil water notice was issued shortly after 8 p.m. on Thursday after a water main broke on Southeast 82nd. The break caused a drop in pressure, which resulted in a water loss to about 100 customers' homes and businesses.